Good morning. So it's Monday. Been here a couple of days.
Can you speak a little louder?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Let me know if you can't hear me. So it's Monday. Welcome. And it's a time when we're settling in, and I felt like I heard it during our service as the chanting got deeper and sort of more tuned into each other. But I also noticed for myself it's a time when things start to come up, and it's possible that's happening with you too. The focus for the first couple of days is just, getting here, being here, learning your positions, and then all of a sudden, you're here. Well, so now it starts to get interesting. And so I hope the rain can teach us a little bit about that, because I just enjoyed it so much this morning. It was a beautiful sound to me. And I often find sounds helpful for sort of focusing my practice, and so having that sound there gave me something to concentrate on and really bring my attention. And it's not just one sound, of course, it's many sounds. It's the sound on the grass, and the sound in the gutter, and the sound on the pavement and on the porch, and the wind changes the sound. And so I found myself entering into it, and at the same time sort of realizing that this rain is a sound that I've heard before, and I have memories of rain since the time I was childhood. And it wasn't just a memory that was coming up, it's more that the rain itself sort of holds the past and is part of the present in all its uniqueness, and spreads out everywhere that it reaches. So, I don't know, I enjoyed that thought, but I really appreciated sort of that unique moment. Coming up here, I was busy, and it was hard getting here. It was hard closing out at work. I know when I arrived here, many of you had been setting up, and it seemed like that had been a piece of work. And I also was in, or continue to be in, really just a certain amount of distress about the world, what I'm reading in the newspapers and what I'm seeing around me. And I had this thought several times before getting here of, I just need to get away, because it's starting to feel like too much work, too much stuff going on, too much scary things to consider or think about, and I'm really glad to be leaving. I kind of alluded to this already, but, there's actually no getting away. I took a walk on the main road, and there's still some houses with flags and some houses without flags, and deer wandering all over the properties, which is, not natural. And I saw some immigrant workers on nearby. If we pay attention, there's no escape from this moment. What's there is here. And I think that part of what we're doing here is allowing ourselves to be with that, because when life sort of presents itself with all these difficult things, I know I just want to escape, frankly. It doesn't feel good, and it's scary, and I don't know what to do. So a couple of months ago, my mother, who I had been the primary caretaker for about 5 years, passed away after a long illness. And when that happened, it was a very intense couple of months of bringing in hospice and being with her while she was in the process of dying. And then right after that, you know, I had my family come into town, and lots of conversations with people. And it was intense, very intense. And I also missed several Zazenkais because of the timing of this. And so I didn't get sort of my monthly fix, you know, of Zen. And simultaneously, the Northampton Sangha that I've been sitting with has sort of been dissipating a little bit, at least at this moment. And so a couple of long-time sitters have had changes in their life circumstances, and they haven't been coming, and people were coming and going, and we eventually decided to let go of the space that we had been renting just, you know, several hours a week for a variety of reasons. And so anyway, suffice it to say that I reached this point where, you know, things kind of felt like they were disintegrating. And at the same time that this was happening, I kind of stopped sitting. And it wasn't intentional. It happened, I think started happening right around, things were sort of really coming to a lot of intensity with my mother, and I was exhausted, and I just kind of felt like I needed to indulge myself, you know, and rather than get up and sit first thing in the morning, it just felt really nice to sit on the porch or sit in the living room and have a cup of coffee. And so suddenly, you know, I wasn't sitting. And all those factors combined kind of led me to this place of, like, what am I doing? What am I doing? You know, this big chapter in my life has come to a close. My sangha's falling apart. My sangha in New York, well, what's that, really? You know, once a month, what is that? I just, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, and I was kind of worked up about it. So eventually I did have a meeting with a teacher, and I present my koan of the moment, I don't know what I'm doing, and the teacher said, are you sitting? And then reminded me, in lecture format, that Zen is sitting, and if you're not sitting, you're not doing Zen. And so that was helpful. Didn't feel good, but it was helpful. So when all of this was going on, and then we have the letters coming out from our Shuso and Roshi, and we have this text of Bendoa, I was curious, you know, why Bendoa at this time? Why Bendoa at this time of so much trouble in the world? You know, we could have a text that talked about, you know, right action or will, or, you know, I don't know, you know, what does it mean to, like, connect with the absolute? But instead we have this very kind of basic text about sitting. Dogen says pretty much the same thing this teacher said to me. Now all ancestors and all Buddhas who uphold Buddha Dharma have made it the true path of unfolding enlightenment to sit upright, practicing in the midst of receptive samadhi. From the first time you meet a master, without depending on incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha names, repentance, or reading scriptures, just wholeheartedly sit, and thus drop away body and mind. Okay, so a couple of people are telling me this, and but what I noted, you know, the thing, one of the things that leapt out for me in the text, besides, you know, this was the same thing that Bokushu and then Roshi also referred to, is this question of trust. And not just trust, but trust and a teacher. So Dogen says, "The realm of all Buddhas inconceivable, it cannot be reached by intellect, much less can those who have no trust or lack wisdom know it. Only those who have the great capacity of genuine trust can enter this realm. Those who have no trust are unable to accept it, however much they hear it. Even at the assembly on Vulture Peak, there were those who were told by Shakyamuni Buddha, 'You may leave if you wish.' When genuine trust arises, practice and study with a teacher. If it does not, wait for a while." And then he says, "Therefore, set aside your doubt, practice Zazen under an authentic teacher, and actualize Buddha's receptive samadhi." So, what are we supposed to trust? Trust in Allah, but tether your scissors? Trust the teachings, but hold some part of yourself in reserve, maybe? Trust, but verify? Question one. Dogen says, "Those within the gate of the Buddha ancestors' authentic transmission venerate an accomplished adept who has attained the way and merged with realization, and entrust this master with the upholding Buddha Dharma. Can this master not fail to clarify the means to illumine their mind ground? Can we trust the teacher?" Well, Roshi mentioned that there's been recent Sangha that's had a terrible amount of trouble with their teacher, and that's not the first. I'm sure we've all heard of these stories where you have, you know, beautiful, seemingly large, energetic sanghas, and then you kind of discover that there's something really unhealthy going on underneath it. And, you know, when I read about this particular sangha, I just felt so sad and so disillusioned. But in fact, I'm not sure what the right, it's a complex emotion, really, because at first I noticed by saying, well, that's them, you know, we don't have that here. We have a healthy sangha with a good set of teachers, and, you know, something must be wrong that with them, you know, that this could have happened. But in fact, the people who went to that sangha are not any different than us, I don't think. Like us, they experience dukkha. Maybe it's big suffering of grief or anger or despair, or maybe it's littler sufferings like dissatisfaction. Right? We've set a life out for ourselves. Everything seems to be going along the way we're told it's going to go along. And we're not okay for some reason, you know? And we suspect and we know in our heart that there is a different way of doing it, but we don't know what that way is. And so we seek out that way. So these people are seekers like us. What brought them there brought us here. And then when we arrive at the place with the teachings and the teacher, we actually see other people and the teacher manifesting what we haven't been able to manifest in our life. They seem more spontaneous, more open, more loving, less fearful, less anxious, and we say, yeah, like, I want that, and that's possible. And in fact, the teachers have had some insight. They are less fearful and more spontaneous and less anxious. So I think a couple things happen, and I'm just imagining this. One is that when the student and teacher meet, there's intimacy. And when there's intimacy, there can be love, and there can be deep connection, and that's beautiful. And with that can come the dropping of some of our boundaries, and we want those boundaries to drop because we feel that they're holding us back. Because we feel we're uptight. We're not spontaneous. Of course, the problem is that, and well, so even before I get to that, you know, it's really only recently in Western history, I think, that we've said so clearly to ourselves, you know, no, there should not be these kinds of relationships. I think oftentimes, in many traditions, there was real meetings, unions between teachers and students, and that way was, in fact, venerated. But we know that that's terribly confusing for everybody that's involved. And then especially when it comes with deception, secrecy, lying, not being able to be honest, when we don't know that it's happening, it's in the dark. So what started out maybe as a genuine love and connection now has to be hidden, and that gets twisted. So that's terrible when something, that intimacy becomes distorted. And then the other thing that seems to happen sometimes is there's a confusion about what it means to be spontaneous and free. And certainly, you know, when we read stories of ancient Zen masters, there's lots of behavior in there that we would say, like, I wouldn't want anybody hitting at me and shouting at me like that. Like, that's not okay. But it is a teaching method, and it can be seen as an expression of spontaneous openness, responsiveness, and when we are in a position of wanting to escape our predicament, be more free ourselves, we may end up not, we may tell ourselves that we should let our boundaries go. And that behavior that's okay is actually there to help us. And the teacher who is wise actually knows how we're supposed to respond and what we're supposed to do next. And so we end up denying our bodies and our minds. And we say, well, there's really no separation between me and others, so I shouldn't have those boundaries. Right. Then when you put on top of that the fact that we have a bureaucracy, you know, we have institutions and forms that have to support the space, that has to support the Sangha, has to support the teachings, has to support the teacher. You know, look how much work just goes into running this one session. And many of these, we're all, you know, it's going on and on. We need those forms in order to have civilization. And yet those forms are self-creating. And they resist challenge. And they resist what might want question it. So then we have that closing in, and there's not the space anymore for the problems to actually come to light. So I personally think that these instances are opportunities for us to look at what is healthy form and healthy power and healthy hierarchy. Because I'm not sure, especially in the West, where we are so committed to democracy, I tend to think we get confused when we have hierarchy. And we either reject it completely, or we just give up everything going into it and accepting it. And how can we find our voice to have both? And, you know, it's just a mirror of what's going on in our whole society. It's not unique to Buddhist groups or spiritual groups. So I guess in answer to that question, no, you know, not absolutely. Question two. Well, if we can't absolutely trust the teacher, can we trust the self? So what is the self? Sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness. There's nothing here, solid here, we can hang our hat on. Our self is dependent on causes and conditions, on our karma, on our genetic makeup. We experience the world through our eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, phenomena. But these are empty. There's nothing to trust or not trust here. Question three. You say the self has no substance and is subject to the laws of impermanence. What about the contents of the self, such as our ideas that can live on well beyond our passing and influence future generations? Can we trust our ideas and our intellect? Well, Dogen talks a bit about this, but I wanted to mention something I read recently. It was an article in the New Yorker a couple of months ago, and it was about the flat earth phenomenon. So this was new to me, but there are a lot of people in our country who sincerely think the earth is flat, okay? And they don't think the earth is flat because they've cloistered themselves in some remote enclave and haven't heard about what we've learned since the Enlightenment and, you know, are just refusing to acknowledge science or math or anything like that. They actually think that there is a science-based reason for the earth being flat, and they can prove it. And they have lots of very good intellectual arguments that you might have a hard time refuting if you came up across them. And unless you really know your science well, their science actually sounds pretty good a lot of the time, sometimes a little less so, but you know, that's their intellect coming up with good intellectual arguments. Well, our intellect comes up with other arguments and we think ours are right. But when do we know for sure that our argument is right or not right? The journalist was interviewing people and was speaking with a truck driver. And I quote, the truck driver brought up the notion of infinite space and the lack of a creator. Quote, how can people live like that? Unquote. The trucker goes on to say, those people are fucking miserable. They're so unhappy. I love that truck driver. I mean, it's true. How do you live on a ball that's hurtling through space and time at some insane speed? You know, and you can't trust a teacher, and you can't trust yourself. How do you live? Question four. We understand that the intellect and science is insufficient. Can we then trust our feelings? Okay, I hope we know the answer is no. Question five. I've heard of great adepts in yoga and sport. Can we trust our bodies? No. Your body will betray you. It will get old, sick, and die. And the way it does that has nothing to do with whether you were a good person or a bad person. And you are going to deal with it as well as you can. That will depend on how much pain you have, how good your mind is, what your own story is, what's happening for you in that moment. I'm sorry. No. Question 6. I have heard you always get what you need or what you can handle. I've also heard this problem is a gift. Can we trust the universe? Okay. Let's look at that. So I have two stories here. When I arrived, on the first Saturday, I took a walk, and I walked up the hill, down past the golf course, down the hill, turned around, back up. And as I'm approaching the golf course, a thought rose in me. I was like, I wonder if I can find a golf ball. And sure enough, I took about 4 paces, and I saw it in the distance, in the grass, a golf ball. So I run over, get the golf ball, pick it up, and it says Vice 3. It has a purple dot on it and a date, 01.01.10. That's intense. What does it mean? I don't know. There was purple. I like purple. I like other colors too, but this one was purple. I tried to remember where I might have been. 101.10. I was probably at a session at Wisdom House, but I don't remember that one. I couldn't really relate it to anything. Vice. Okay. I'm being reminded about vice. So what are my vices? There's supposed to be 3 of them. And, like, I'm not bragging, but I don't think I have any vices. I have bad habits. I drink coffee, and I procrastinate, and things like that. But I don't think they rise to the level of vice. So then it occurred to me, maybe I found somebody else's golf ball. Because if I had come here saying, like, I need this retreat to help me get rid of my coffee habit, and then I had found the golf ball, like, that would have been cool. But as it was, I wasn't thinking that. So if you think this golf ball is meant for you, let me know. I'm a roommate. But there's a second part to this story. And I actually have to give you a little bit of background on this. So before I had had my encounter with the teacher who reminded me about sitting, I had another encounter with a different teacher where I was also expressing some of my distress. And this teacher said, very gently, you need to take care of yourself. Find something that you'd love to do now that you have some time and space in your life. So that felt good. And then I left, and about a week later, because I'm impressionable and that teacher is a potter, I thought, I'll do pottery. And so, sure enough, by chance, there was a pottery class starting right away, and I decided to do some pottery. And for some reason, I decided I wasn't going to do wheel building. I was just going to kind of make some little pots by hand. And so I got the idea in my mind that I was going to work with this theme of animals and humans. And so the first little flower pot that I build is a sphinx, which was cool. Then I worked with this image of Ganesh. And I really like this image of Ganesh. He's if you don't know who he is, he's the an Indian Hindu god. I don't even know exactly what he is responsible for, but he's just got this great vibe. He's kind of plump and happy and long elephant nose. And in this particular image that I was using, he's reclining and he just looks great. And so I start making a pot with the Ganesh. and I'm totally absorbed in it, and I make one, and it took a lot of hours, and I put in a lot of time going in on in between classes to get this thing going, and it comes out pretty good, and I think, you know, I have some things I want to work with, I'm going to do another one, so I do start working on another one, and I am consumed by Ganesh for close to 2 months. So, I have to put the pottery aside, come here, same day that I find the golf ball, that evening, so I put the pottery aside, come here, drive here with Kenko from Northampton, and drop him off at the Gray house, where I leave my car. First day, Saturday, I found the golf ball, it doesn't mean anything. Kinhin, outside Kinhin, walk up the road, it's a beautiful evening, gorgeous wind, start to walk up to the path up to the Gray house, and random thought, I'm going to see my car flutter, flutter. I mean, okay, car has 100,000 miles on it. I've only been parted from it for a day. Why am I thinking this? But I do. Go up. There's my car. It's parked next to it, and it's like a little Volkswagen Golf. You can see the little Volkswagen logo. And it's parked next to another Volkswagen that's a similar kind of Volkswagen. Maybe a wagon. I was like, look, it's parked next to another Volkswagen. And then I look at the license plate of this other car, and it says Ganesh. Okay. I don't care what you say, but I think that's amazing. Like, come on, that's amazing. How could that be? How many Ganesh license plates are there in this country? There just can't be that many of them. And how did one of them, on a Volkswagen no less, end up right next to my Volkswagen? Oh, somebody is saying the hair, okay. Next to my Volkswagen, here, you know, it's just so weird. So what does it mean? I don't know. Like, does it mean you've done enough Ganeshes? This is the third, vice, three, third Ganesh, no more, you do something else? Or does it mean Ganesh is the way to go? No. So the good thing is, Dogen does not tell us to trust in anything. He tells us to trust. Anything is impermanent, subject to death and decay, is going to change. This includes other people, ourselves, our bodies, contents of our mind and our feelings. It includes all of our thought activity, commitments, goals, path. We cannot trust a priori anything outside ourselves, and nor can we trust anything a priori inside ourselves. Dogen is just telling us to trust. Raise the Bodhi mind and trust. Like a child trusts everything until she learns not to touch the fire. How do we trust? We practice. We trust like a grown-up child. We use our accumulated experience and wisdom so that we have some perspective on our emotions and thoughts. And we support ourselves with healthy practices in eating and sleeping and helpful boundaries, not based on fear and anxiety. We don't trust and verify because we're not always holding something back. We can't necessarily trust our reasoning, but that doesn't mean that we have to surrender our critical thinking. how do we do this? We sit and we practice. So after being lectured or reminded, I made the decision to start sitting again. And it was basically because if I was going to stop, I wanted to make a conscious decision. I didn't want to just wake up some months or years from now and discover that I'd stopped without ever having kind of decided that. And so I started sitting again. And after a while, I kind of found that I had stopped being in that crisis that I had been in before. But it's not that I had solved any problems. I did not have any great revelations. It wasn't particularly great sitting. It was normal home sitting, kind of distracted. Originally I thought, I fell off the wagon and got to get back on again. But it's not, I don't think it's like that. Well, at least for me, it wasn't like that at all. You know, I imagine that if you have problems with alcoholism, you know when you're drinking and you know when you stop drinking. And when you stop drinking, you don't wake up with a headache. You don't wake up and say, what did I do last night? You know, the differences are pretty extreme. But for me, I didn't notice that kind of change. But what I think happened is that I started to trust again. And then Dogen says, and when you find that trust, then you find a teacher. And we're lucky. It's just luck. But it's incredible luck. I mean, I just have so much appreciation. You know, the fact that I can get up here and make little digs at the teacher is good, I think. Unless you don't see me for dinner. But, you know, here we are, supporting each other in this practice, generating this trust, working hard, doing our very best with all this support. We're lucky. And so Dogen says, just consider that today is the beginning.